AI PCs built for business with Intel Core Ultra processors and Intel vPro are optimized for hundreds of AI apps and tools to boost user productivity, collaboration, and creativity. No product can be absolutely secure. Learn more at intel.com/itheroes.
Amazon prepares to battle U.S. regulators in court with a breakup of its business at stake. Plus, China bans government workers from using iPhones, and why Japan is Warren Buffett's preferred investment this year.
Investors, having seen the success of noticeable or prominent firms, are now starting to venture more broadly into the Japanese equity market. That gives hope for sustainable outperformance of the market in the coming years.
It's Wednesday, September 6th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin in China, where we've learned that officials at central government agencies have been ordered not to use Apple's iPhones and other foreign-branded devices for work or to bring them into the office. The directive is the latest step in Beijing's campaign to cut reliance on foreign technology and enhance cybersecurity, and comes amid a campaign to limit flows of sensitive information outside of China's borders. The move by Beijing could have a chilling effect for foreign brands in China, with Apple relying on the country for about 19% of its overall revenue. China's State Council Information Office and Apple didn't immediately respond to requests for comment. The Federal Trade Commission and Amazon are setting the stage for a court battle later this month, with people familiar with the discussions saying the e-commerce giant hasn't offered concessions to the FTC in pursuit of a settlement over antitrust claims. Journal tech reporter Sam Schechner says the lawsuit could lead to a breakup of Amazon.
Our reporting shows that the FTC thinks that a structural remedy, i.e. potential divestitures of assets, are what's needed. And it appears from the lack of concessions that Amazon views either its case to be strong or perhaps the stakes are that high. I mean, we've seen in the past the company hasn't been afraid to fight where it thinks it has a good case. It's taken tax cases into EU court where it's won, but it's also settled. It settled a somewhat similar antitrust case in the EU, which also looked at possible bias and granting sellers access to its Prime program.
Amazon's lawyers have reiterated the argument that changes to the company could result in higher prices and slower shipping speeds to customers. Elon Musk may be the world's richest person, but he still needs cash. We're exclusively reporting that he borrowed $1 billion from rocket maker SpaceX last year in the same month that he acquired Twitter. It couldn't be determined why Musk took the debt, which was backed by some of his SpaceX stock and approved by the company's board, though Musk paid it back with interest shortly after. The loan is the latest example of Musk's unusual fundraising techniques, which have allowed him to draw money from his empire of companies without permanently parting with shares. Musk and SpaceX didn't respond to requests for comment. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has made a surprise visit to Ukraine this morning, where he's expected to announce more than $1 billion in additional aid. According to a senior State Department official, Blinken is expected to meet Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the capital, Kyiv, today, in the highest-profile U.S. visit since President Biden's unannounced trip in February. The Pentagon is charging up plans for a vast AI-powered drone fleet to counter threats from China and others. We are exclusively reporting that Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks will detail plans today for developing thousands of small and cheap air, land, and sea-based AI systems, which could be packed with sensors and remain afloat thanks to being powered by the sun. The program is partly driven by advances made from China, which has more ships than the U.S. Navy and has invested in autonomous systems. The former chairman of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio, has received a 22-year prison sentence, the longest in over 1,000 cases linked to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Journal reporter Byron Tao told us that prosecutors had sought 33 years for Tarrio and another Proud Boys member, having applied a rarely used terrorism enhancement to the sentences.
The judge ultimately gave him a much more lenient sentence, saying that in general, sentences of that nature are usually reserved for crimes like blowing up a building or taking up arms against the United States on the battlefield. And as serious as the judge believed January 6th was, he didn't believe that it rose to the level of that kind of a crime. In the big picture, this is the most serious and longest sentence yet doled out as part of the January 6th investigation. The judge said that because of the Proud Boys' leading role in sparking some of the early events that led to the breach of the Capitol, that this sentence was justified.
And Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has returned to work on Capitol Hill. The 81-year-old's health has been in focus lately after he twice froze during recent public events and sustained a concussion during a fall earlier this year. According to a doctor's letter released ahead of remarks in the Senate, McConnell did not have a seizure or movement disorders like Parkinson's disease and had not suffered a stroke or mini-stroke. Coming up, Warren Buffett jump-started an influx of investment into Japan earlier this year, but can the world's third biggest economy sustain its long-awaited rebound? More on that after the break.
Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of futures. At Janus Henderson, we are committed to helping you invest in a brighter future for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
There is something that many international equity investors who have posted big returns this year have in common. They've bet on Japan. The country has been expanding at a surprisingly fast pace this year. In the April through June quarter, annualized GDP growth ran at 6%, while the Nikkei is up north of 27% year to date. Earlier, I spoke to Journal reporter River Davis and Damian Tong, the head of Japan equity research at Macquarie Capital, about the extraordinary year so far for Japanese corporations. River, you cover Japanese businesses for us at the Journal and have seen this transformation firsthand. What has been behind this?
Yeah, we have had very interesting conversations recently with executives from startups to larger companies in Japan, and they've kind of had a moment of stepping back, and some of them expressed surprise in the valuation rise in their companies this year. And I think a lot of that came from the fact that they feel like they've been taking steps to increase investor value for a number of years now. There was a big kind of news about Warren Buffett upping his stakes in some holdings companies in Japan in recent months that kind of inspired more interest broadly in corporate Japan. And also a big factor there, even with Warren Buffett himself, is that investors that follow him have recently said that he's becoming more cautious about investing in companies related to China. So perhaps this kind of more cautious nature towards the world's second economy is making Japan, the world's third largest economy, look like a safer bet.
Damian, over to you. How has this bullishness on Japan played out from your perspective?
I think there's definitely been a lot of work done in the last 10, 15 years, and a very large number of Japanese firms really improving the fundamentals of their businesses. And these have included companies like Sony, those that are less well-known like Daikin, companies like Hitachi, which of course is known in certain circles, but has really faded from the eye of many investors. But if you look at their actual financial performance, it's night and day. If you were to look back at what they were making, the volatility of the earnings back in the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s, You know, today we're seeing a sustained round of some of the highest return on equity on many of these firms. While unknown or unwatched by many, the Japanese firms were now generating as high or as good profit margins as some of the best European industrial peers. And of course, what was interesting, this was coming at a time when there was also a bit of angst, I think, in certain parts of the US and Europe. And the realization that Japanese firms were starting to outpace or outperform some of their Western peers was starting to be very striking. Now, I think there's another factor that's come in too, which is that if you look at what Japan's industrial base is, it's kind of bread and butter, kind of dull. The making of widgets, metal parts, certain electronic components. But it turns out that the pandemic made a lot of people realize how important Japan still is to global supply chains.
And in terms of trying to figure out how long this run can continue, we don't see an end, do we, to this trend of nearshoring, of setting up supply chains in new parts of the world? And by extension, it sounds like these Japanese firms are well positioned to help countries, to help companies all over the place build these new networks.
I think so. And one crucial place where you do see these dynamics is the semiconductor supply chain, where companies like Tokyo Electron, many of these producers of semiconductor manufacturing equipment, raw materials, high technology materials going to semiconductors. In some of these cases, of course, we've seen a bit of a downturn, but their profits in the prior year were the highest in their history. And their market share, their profitability suggests they'll remain very important in the coming years as governments and companies attempt and work to shift their supply chains towards reduced dependence on China. So I think this is a golden moment, and I believe that the next 10 years will present an excellent opportunity for many of these companies.
And what are you finding in terms of the savviness of investors and their ability to pick up on the nuances of where success lies in this economy?
Many investors are ultimately pattern matchers. We build our investment intuition always on what we've seen elsewhere in many cases or seen in the past. In some sense, a Japanese equivalent or something that they're familiar with abroad. I've made this analogy before that when tourists come to Japan, they'll get a copy of the Michelin Guide. But really the fun of Japan for all of us who live here knows is that that's not the best restaurants. Are we in the second wave or the third wave where you actually start exploring the far hinterlands of Japan's industrial base? I think we're not there yet, for sure. It takes time. Part of it, of course, is that language is a barrier. Many smaller firms may not be accessible easily still, even today, but it's getting better. And then two, I think there is now, partly because of the Tokyo Stock Exchange, the ecosystem, of wanting or a recognition that we really want to basically bring up the stories out into the public eye. Investors, having in some sense seen the success of noticeable or prominent firms, are now starting to venture more broadly into the Japanese equity market. That gives hope for a sustainable outperformance of the market in the coming years.
All right, so some potential there for success, River. And yet, just going through our recent coverage, there do seem to be a lot of caveats around this. Our bureau chief, Peter Landers, wrote recently that Japan is indeed basking in the glow of this economic dynamism. And yet there have been examples in the past of politicians hiking taxes just as the seeds of growth start to form. Other of your colleagues have written that corporate culture may need to shift towards increasing buybacks or raising price to book values. These are massive changes, River, at the corporate and political level. Do you see signs they're actually going to occur?
I think this has bled down into the way that executives are running companies in Japan. There's been kind of these prominent qualms from investors that Japanese companies are not quick enough to change. They sit on a lot of cash that could be used to invest. They take stake in each other, cross shareholdings. A number of issues that have gone years and years without seeing too much progress, but I think it's been quiet progress through the years. So we've seen moves from Toyota, which has announced its plan to decrease cross-shareholdings, to actively buy back shares when it can. There's pressure from the Tokyo Stock Exchange, from regulators on companies to increase their valuations. Price-to-book ratio is not a perfect kind of measure of whether or not a company is valued accurately or not, but about half of companies listed in Japan have a price-to-book ratio of less than one, which is a sign that they may be undervalued.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter River Davis, as well as Damian Tong, the head of Japan Equity Research at Macquarie Capital. Damian, River, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. Today's show was produced by Mohsen Ali and Kate Bullivant. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back tonight with a new show. And until then, thanks for listening.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.